Good morning. After all the uncertainty, the stress, the bitten nails, all the tense scenarios of how it might go so very oofosok, we might have been saved by novelty socks.
I love these socks. What's with these socks?
President Trump.
I'm trying to stay focused, but I'm very impressed with the VP socks.
All praise the shamrock socks worn by JD Vance. And against the backdrop of other recent Oval Office meetings, this went off without major incident. No walkouts, no bust-ups. On Drive Time, Cormac and Sarah got this analysis from Miles McCormick, Washington correspondent with the Financial Times, and Dr. Graeme Finlay, School of Politics and International Relations at UCD.
Today, to some extent, he was playing to the galleys in Irish America, and that, as I kind of said in the meeting, many of whom came out to vote for him, and it plays well politically in the US for him to be kind of seen to be on good terms with Ireland. So, yeah, I mean, from the US point of view, from the president's point of view, it's kind of an audience well beyond the Oval Office, well beyond the White House, and well beyond DC that he's speaking to.
Yeah, I wonder, did he take his cue from the vice president breakfast with JD Vance? That was such a convivial atmosphere, wasn't it, Graeme? Or is this type of work, this groundwork done in the weeks and months before this meeting?
I mean, the groundwork is done, and we do have to praise our diplomats who do a terrific job. Again, I think everything went well because J.D. Vance and Donald Trump decided it was going to go well. I think the point about one reason they wanted it to go well is this point about Irish-American voters. It's really important to know that Donald Trump thinks in stereotypes, and he thinks in terms of ethnic identification. And a lot of his regrettable comments over the years have turned on those kinds of things. So I think he would think that Irish Americans are going to identify with Ireland possibly more than they actually do, and might, you know, vote for him on the basis of how well he treats Ireland. Mm. So again, we see a very deliberate performance by the president and vice president. And when they were determined for it to go well, everything sort of fell into place.
And certainly there was quite the variety of topics bouncing around that meeting. Doonbeg, Conor McGregor, the origins of the EU, the housing crisis, apparently an indicator of our economic success, and Rosie O'Donnell. And giving his verdict on the Taoiseach's handling of the meeting, Aidan Regan, Professor of Political Economy at UCD, with Áine on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
So how did he walk the diplomatic tightrope?
I thought he walked it very well, actually. He didn't feel the need to intervene that much. It was a very long conversation. I think for the first time, a lot of Irish people probably got exposed to the extent of these things and actually got to listen to Donald Trump elaborate on some of his points. We're so used to getting things in snippets and, mm-hmm. and tweets and so on. And a lot of what he said made a lot of sense, quite frankly. And there was a lot of rationale to his arguments about why he wants to protect US industry. And there was a lot of rationale to his argument on peace, etc. So I could see why Micheál Martin, when he did intervene or did make a contribution, it was largely complimenting and corroborating what Donald Trump was saying. So I think from the Irish state's perspective, it was, it went well for them.
But not everyone thought Taoiseach Micheál Martin got the balance right. Cormac spoke to Sinn Féin's spokesperson on foreign affairs, Donnacha O'Leary.
It did not turn into a fiasco. Having said that, there were definitely elements of it that I was disappointed with. I think he was offered an opportunity to make clear Ireland's position in relation to Gaza. He didn't do that. I think, in particular, his reaction to Donald Trump's joke and remark in relation to housing crisis, I thought that was quite revealing, to be honest, given the significant human suffering, really, that we're still dealing with in Ireland in the housing crisis. To talk about that as a mark of success, whatever about Donald Trump saying it, for Micheál Martin to say that was a good answer, I think was disappointing. So
yeah,
there were elements.
But can I come back to that? What do you think he should have said on Gaza?
Well, I think he should have made clear what Ireland's position was. And I think there was a way of doing that that was sober, recognising differences, but making it very clear that Ireland was completely opposed to any departure from the two-state solution. I think there were disappointing elements.
But in the midst of all the misty bagarres, there was also some tough talking on trade. And President Trump took the time to single out one sector in particular.
The pharmaceutical company started to go to Ireland. I would have said, that's okay if you want to go to Ireland. I think it's great. But if you want to sell anything into the United States, I'm going to put a 200% tariff on you. So you're never going to be able to sell anything into the United States. You know what they would have done? They would have stayed here.
And with Ireland as the world's third largest exporter of pharmaceuticals, well, this was always going to be on his radar. But even so, Ireland seemed to get away with it. On Drive Time, here's former US correspondent Brian O'Donovan.
If you were to say to me in advance of this meeting that he would say the words, we have a massive deficit that we need to sort out, we're bringing back our pharmaceutical companies, I'm not happy with the way Apple is being treated, you'd have said, oh my God, this was a disaster for Ireland. It wasn't. Because every single time he sort of criticised the situation with companies, it would be, but I don't blame Ireland. It's not your fault. You guys are smart. I would have done the same. I blame my predecessors, the previous administrations that let this happen. And at one stage...
Nevertheless, it was our trade surplus that was on everyone's mind, and not helped by the EU's announcement on Wednesday of its tariffs to counter the US's tariffs on steel and aluminium. Potentially tricky timing for Micheál Martin, his former Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern.
Should he have, do you think, stuck up a bit more for the EU?
No, I don't think he should have. And
really?
To be honest, if it hadn't been me, Sarah, I would have been very annoyed at them, the EU, for deciding to make their statements this morning. That wasn't very helpful to the Taoiseach, I can tell you. So I'd say he was probably sharing a bit of frustrations about the EU as he drove over.
And his take on how it all went down?
You said in advance, Bertie, that if it was boring, it would be great. Was it boring, do you think?
Yes.
Well, that's something, I suppose. But make no mistake, the EU is in Trump's crosshairs. Claire spoke to economist David McWilliams.
Trump made it very, very clear yesterday just how viscerally anti-EU he is. He continued to almost make the case as if Ireland was a sort of an unwilling hostage of this nasty EU. And he hasn't got a problem with you, Ireland, but I've got a problem with the EU. He also obviously wants to and is imposing tariffs on the EU. And there is a fascinating, Claire, historical link between all this. Trump has said that his main hero is a guy called William McKinley, who was the president in the 1890s and early 1900s. And this was a period where McKinley was referred to as the Napoleon of tariffs, right? And the US raised about 50% of its total tax take from tariffs. That's the first thing. The second thing, that was a period where America was this sort of pioneer, new country thrusting out to the West, but also isolated from Europe. Their entire policy was, let's not get involved. So I see this as almost Trump and Vance and the MAGA movement trying to go back to a period in history which they think was a golden age. And in order to go back there, they must replicate the policies of that golden age. And those policies are tariffs and anti-European, anti-getting involved in the rest of the world. Now, the problem for us, of course, is that that period when America was involved in Europe, what they call the rule-based order, was very much adopted by and protected by the United States, was a golden age for Ireland, because we could do what we could never do in the past, which was we could trade with the big boys on terms that were favourable to us. Now, as you know, those terms are being changed by Trump, and of course the European Union is reacting. So in a way, we are caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle. David McWilliams with Claire. And finally, to round off the week, members of the Burke family from County Mayo were ejected from the Ireland Fund's gala dinner in Washington, D.C. Enoch Burke's mother Martina, brother Isaac and sister Amy started shouting about Mr. Burke's detention.
The luck of the Irish is truly with me because of those family connections that were first planted in County Leash.
And that clip from Morning Ireland yesterday. And staying in the US and Trump, but changing focus ever so slightly, with Oliver, financial journalist Michael Lewis. You'll know his books, The Big Short, Moneyball, The Blind Side. And he's just edited a book of essays entitled Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service. Not exactly screaming page-turner.
civil service, who thinks they want to read about it? Normally, it's like writing about, you know, ice melting. But Trump electrified the material.
Essentially, by cutting federal funding and jobs, Trump inadvertently shone a light on the essential role of government. And in this book, Lewis wants to highlight the important behind-the-scenes work of civil servants. And he believes that in every department, you will find quiet heroes.
I grabbed out of a hat the name of a civil servant just because his profile was curious to me. It said Christopher Marks worked as a former coal miner, has solved the problem of coal mine roofs collapsing on the heads of coal miners, which took the lives of countless miners in the last 100 years. I didn't know the problem. I didn't know his existence. I didn't know that there had been a solution. 100,000 coal miners in the United States in the 20th century died, half of them from roofs falling on their heads. The market never thought to solve this problem. The coal mining companies sort of acclimated the working man to a level of risk, acculturated them to it, so that even though they had the technology to solve the problem, there was never any pressure on them to solve the problem. It was just assumed that this was a dangerous job, even though it didn't have to be as dangerous.
And they didn't have the power.
And they didn't. The workers didn't have the power. Mm. It took this researcher in the government to care enough about it to attack the problem and figure out how you keep these roofs from falling on the heads of people. All the writers found these characters and these people who were doing things that wouldn't be done by the market, that are that mean life and death to ordinary citizens. And isn't it amazing that we've reached a point in our society anyway where the citizens are numb enough to what's going on that they'll allow a president to come in and try to dismantle the operation at great peril to themselves.
And he made this impassioned plea for the plight of the civil servant.
Our government has been bashed by politicians, both sides, mainly Republicans, mm-hmm. but both sides, for 50 years. It has no real ability to defend itself. Like, civil servants know that all attention is bad attention. Civil servants know that if you stick your head up, it gets whacked off. And you just lay low and do your job. You don't get paid a lot of money. It's not glamorous work. So who ends up there? And this is what I think the book reveals: people who are very mission driven, who find some problem they're interested in solving that can only be solved inside the federal government. And people who are sort of purpose driven that way, who sort of like they're like dogs with a bone. I'm going to stop roofs from falling in on the heads of coal miners, they end up being much more interesting characters than, say, your average Wall Street banker who just wants money. It's just like they're after something really important. And may sound like it's hyperbole and like I'm putting it too strongly. In the end, we were writing about people who'd figured out the secret to life, the secret to leading a meaningful life. All these people have incredibly meaningful lives. They're serving other people. And what's going on in our government now is people who serve themselves have taken over. And they're attacking people who serve up.
Michael Lewis with Oliver. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was a definite whiff of the apocalypse off the radio this week. And it might be the weekend for it, because in last night's Our Divine Sparks, Dermot MacDonald went so far as to name call St. Patrick himself.
It maybe sounds as if he was a little bit of a crackpot.
A crackpot? On this, the most sacred of Irish weekends? Explain yourself. Well, all of this because of a doomsday line from St. Patrick's Confessio, written in the 5th century. Here's Thomas O'Loughlin, Emeritus Professor of Historical Theology with the University of Nottingham.
He has this bizarre phrase where he says, he ordained clergy. Okay, well, we've just talked on that. He baptised people. Okay, that. And then he says, and he got a people ready. I think this is some sort of ritual he was putting his groups through so that they are ready for the end. I think what happened was he was doing this in one place in Ireland. He's ordaining, baptizing, and putting these people through this strange getting ready for the end ritual, which he doesn't describe. He takes it for granted. We know what it's like. And we have no idea. And then probably the next bishop, 2 or 3 miles up the road, says, he's doing what? This guy has gone rogue. And having gone rogue, they're telling him, you don't have a valid ministry. You shouldn't be preaching this sort of stuff.
The way you describe that, Tom, it maybe sounds as if he was a little bit of a crackpot, or perhaps in that missionary tradition of being very zealous and political and radical and really, really doing his own thing.
Apocalypticism is not to be explained by theologians. It's to be explained by psychologists. If you're able to read what's happening in the world as signs that the end is about to happen, you know, you can use the word crackpot. It's not a very scientific term, but it may capture a very significant truth.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to call our patron saint a crackpot. However, Elizabeth...
Well, apocalypticism attracts a very peculiar type of people.
St. Patrick, in a whole new light, from our divine sparks. He was in to talk all things fire, but then Shane Bergen of UCD got sidetracked.
Absolutely extraordinary. I shouldn't say that on national radio, but one day if we discover that there is alien life, it'll most likely be due to a spectroscopic technique. We'll be looking for signals in distant atmospheres, and we can do this, like exoplanets that are thousands of light years away. We'll be able to look and see what their atmospheres are made out of, and we may be able to distinguish elements that are in their atmospheres that would be absolutely indicative of life.
Were you about to say when we discover alien
life?
I reckon,
even though the universe is enormous, I reckon it is probably within my lifetime that we will discover that life could be possible in other places. Mm-hmm. We look at Mars at the moment. There's numerous missions that are being sent to Mars to look for the fossilized remains of life. Because when Mars and the Earth were formed billions of years ago, both had the perfect conditions for life to form on them. Of course, Mars lost its atmosphere, and so life, if it was there, would have died out. But it had all the conditions, the right amount of heat, it had liquid water, etc. So life may have taken hold there. If it has taken hold in more than one place, it's quite likely that other solar systems in the universe would have had the right conditions for life as well. So the conditions we will look for are spectroscopic, and the other one is what you do, Claire, radio signals. Can we identify signals from distant planets that would be giving off basically radio signals that would identify them as intelligent?
Well, we're going off topic.
Mm-hmm. Going off topic is right, Claire. And she was getting ready to jump ship right now.
Could the right conditions exist now somewhere else? In other words, could there be a mirror planet to Earth somewhere?
Well, mirror planet is a different question. Could the right conditions? Yes. Is that life intelligent? We don't know. There's a famous thing called the Drake equation, which works out the probability of there being another intelligent civilization out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been that in the universe, there's probably somewhere between 1 and 10 other civilizations out there that are like us. But we now realize, unfortunately, that clever species like ourselves are not as clever as we think, because the likelihood of us going extinct due to our own activities is increasing. So how long would an intelligent civilization last is the last piece of the Drake equation. So we may only exist for a flash in the timeline of the universe, because we will do things like burn too many things, create
like
too much carbon dioxide.
Which we're talking about today. Listen, come back.
Shane Bergen with Claire. But if the end of the world is nigh, maybe an opportunity to get out for a wee ramble before we all burn. And if you're lucky enough to be in County Clare, you could head to the Burren in the company of Cormac McGinley.
So I live about 6 or 7 fields back from the Cliffs of Moher.
Ooh, envy. Now, McGinley gives tours around the Burren, and he talked about its unique landscape, a geologist's playground.
You've got to go back to the formation of the Burren. So if you think that we're all kind of sitting on tectonic plates, they're sort of drifting around.
Mm.
So like the plates we're on today, like we're moving away from the States at about the speed your fingernails grow at. And so if you go back in time 300 million years, that area, this part of the Earth's surface, was actually south of the equator. And it was covered by a shallow tropical sea. And limestone is formed when sea creatures extract calcium carbonate from their environment to build their shells and their hard parts.
Right.
And then as they die, all those hard parts sink to the bottom. And the accumulation of those is limestone. And so you've got like over 100 bands of limestone in the Burren, all sitting on top of each other. But 290 million years ago, all of that was pushed up above sea level by a tectonic impact.
Right.
And it cracked all those layers.
That's what we're looking at.
So you're looking at all these layers that have been shoved up. and they've all got these fine cracks, initially fine cracks, but because limestone is alkaline and rainwater is slightly acidic, when rain falls on it, it finds the cracks and drops through them and slightly dissolves the rock. And over thousands of years, the track that the water follows becomes cave systems. And so all the water that falls on the burn tends to vanish into these cave systems very fast. So you don't have bog formation or boggy ground. So you can leave animals out on fields and they're not turning them to muck. They're not chewing them up. They've got dry ground, even in the wettest winter. And then the other factor is that the exposed limestone takes on heat all summer and then releases it in the winter. And so grass stops growing once your temperature gets below 8 degrees.
Yeah.
But in the Burren, you've got a much longer grass growing season because the limestone is keeping the heat up. So you'll drive past it and think, that looks crazy. But they're actually on dry ground with growing grass, where everywhere else in the country, they've got to take their animals in and put them in sheds and feed them.
And when you're in the midst of rock, so very ancient, well, you get something of a perspective.
All of the rock in County Clare dates back to sort of between 315 and 360 million years ago. So literally anything you lay your hand on is from that time period. So you're finding fossils, shells and corals, and you know, lots of stuff like that, and all of it dates back to that time. And when you realise you're kind of walking through or over that sort of landscape, it has a similar effect to, like, most people get this feeling when they stargaze. If they sit outside and they look at stars, it gives you that feeling that you're insignificant, but not in a depressing way, more in a sort of a freeing way, that none of your problems really matter. Well, when you're on kind of rock like that and you realise the age of it, and you're sort of getting your own perspective on it, you're like, look at nothing we're worrying about.
Don't worry about hundreds of
millions. Matters that much.
Cormac McGinley with Oliver. And with Ray, a similar kind of thinking, and one we can all try to keep in the head, paying attention to those we love right here, right now. Here's Joe Humphreys.
What does secular prayer sound like or look like?
Secular prayer, one philosopher, for instance, I'd cite here, Simone Veil, who focuses, or she describes secular prayer, and she describes it as attention. She describes it as looking, I suppose, in an unselfish manner at, particularly when you're with somebody, or thinking about somebody, you're not thinking about yourself, you know, purely. So it's another philosopher kind of builds off that, Iris Murdoch, Irish-born philosopher. I suppose she kind of describes the feeling of secular prayer one time when she was kind of in a state of kind of being distracted herself. She was dwelling on something that happened to her, feeling her ego had been harmed. She looked up in the sky and she saw a bird flying, and she just looked at the bird and thought of the bird, thought of the bird's place in the world, thought of her place in the world, thought, you know, I'm part of a bigger thing here. Just a very simple kind of image. And that was a kind of a prayer. And she sort of describes that as really the start of a higher level of consciousness around the world. You know, that is kind of an entry point into a kind of a richer way of living. Yeah. There's a moral dimension to this, because, you know, people often do get angry when they're distracted and so on. And what she says is that, like, she approaches the whole question of attention through love and asks the question, what is it to love someone? And she boils it down to attention, you know, unselfish attention to others.
That's interesting.
So if you want to be able to love, if you want to have the capacity to love in your life, you have to be able to train your attention. Give someone outside of yourself attention for a start, but then actually have the generosity to give some other person your undivided attention.
And then, to continue something of a theme, with movies and musicals at the weekend as part of the Dublin International Film Festival, Aideen's public interview with Jessica Lange. And this question.
I'm wondering, Jessica, as we spoke about you starting out in 1976 and being slightly overwhelmed by life at the time, what advice would you give to young Jessica now, looking back?
Oof. Well, I guess I would, a couple things. I would definitely say, again, hearkening back to this idea of staying present, always present, and paying attention, really paying attention to everything, to the relationships, to the work, to the family, to the, sometimes I feel like I went through life in this kind of, I don't know, distracted. I hope that's not true, but sometimes I feel like I wish I could do it again and just pay attention to every single moment. I would also say to young Jessica, don't do those movies you're worried about. Don't do them. Just stay home. Just stay home.
Jessica Lange on movies and musicals with Aideen at the weekend. Fine advice. Now to Liveline and a story that was really shocking. Poison pen letters, an almost archaic term for what Susan Plower and her husband and their family were going through.
Susan Plower. Susan, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm okay, but if I was getting these letters, I presume you're frightened, you're distressed. These are poison pen letters, savage, venomous, threatening poison pen. When did they start, Susan?
They started, Joe, in January 2020.
And were they directed at you initially, at your family?
The first letter that actually came was addressed to the parents of our eldest son.
Okay.
And it was coming from a concerned parent. And it was just basically telling us that our son was involved in drugs.
Oh, God. And it was an anonymous letter, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, they're all anonymous.
Yeah. And then it progressed. How many do you think you've got in the last 5 years? Five years?
Yeah, we're into our sixth year now, really. Yeah, we have well over 500, but that's including, it's gone to work colleagues, family, friends, members of our family. People that we don't even know have gotten letters now, not necessarily about us, about their own families, but it's the same person.
And it's the same person because of the way the...
Yeah.
The photographs?
Yeah, we've gotten photographs, pornographic images and heads superimposed onto pornographic images and body parts superimposed and that kind of thing, yeah. Condoms, we got a condom in our latest letter. There was a supposed used condom in a Ziploc bag. And that's not the first time.
And whoever this person or people are, they know the family.
But some of the letters I've read are very threatening, apart from anything else.
Yeah,
they obviously have been. They know where you live. They photograph. Yes. They can tell you reg numbers.
Yes. They're and obviously, they've told us that they know our every move. That they told us at one stage that they'd a camera in the wall at our house. They told us that they see us coming and going from the house. They told us recently in a most recent letter that they were going to come into our property and spit on our cars. Whatever that will achieve, who knows?
And with so much of the language in these letters unfit for broadcast, Joe could only read out certain parts. Even so, it's quite disturbing.
The word around town is now that ye are sending the letters to your right ear, yourselves looking for attention. Now, do you? This is in the letter, and it's the letters are closely typed too. This one is an A4 page front and back. Mm-hmm. I'd say it took maybe up to an hour to write it. They must have little else to be doing apart from pouring out this venom and poison. Exactly. Now they say to you, do you really want another year or more of if this, it should be of this, question marks. Mm-hmm. I see everything you do, every skank car you drive, everything in capitals. I don't care what ye do, where ye go, what ye drive. I don't care even care if ye are on the verge of separation. Ye have nothing. I won't even read out the next sentence. Mm-hmm. You have nothing on me.
Yep.
And the writer. And my back is well covered.
Mm-hmm.
And then they finish it the last line. And as I say, it goes on. And every expletive, reg numbers. Catch me if you can.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a vile word at the end there.
Yeah. They sign off most of their letters. Catch me if you can.
Now the Plowers have gone to the Gardaí, but with no real result. They do try to ignore them, but the letters just keep on coming. It's unrelenting. And Susan talked about the impact of all of this on their family.
When that first letter came, I tore the house asunder thinking that Callum was involved with drugs, and He wasn't. He clearly wasn't. This is what this person intended to do. And I did question Dave and go, God, maybe he is having affairs, you know. Or, but apparently it's me now that's having the affair.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's yeah, it is. It does affect. It does affect.
And then do I presume at different times that you even doubt your friends, or you look at somebody and say, hang on, did they say that to me 27 years ago at a wedding or something, and maybe they have a grudge against me?
Absolutely. Should they maintained that they were at our wedding. This person had said that they were at our wedding. So, of course, yeah, you're wondering, I wonder, is it or was it or could it be? Absolutely.
And those suspicions have seeped into her everyday interactions in her own community.
I hope you're okay. I know, but I say it's extraordinarily...
Yeah, I suppose for a long time it was, you know, we'd be very kind of keep ourselves to ourselves anyway. We'd be very quiet.
Yeah.
We're not drinkers. We're not socializers.
Okay.
As such, like we have our circle of friends and we stick to those friends. And if we go somewhere, we go for something to eat. For the longest time, I wouldn't even do my grocery shopping. I didn't want to do my grocery. I would do my grocery shopping normally in Loughrea, but I was going anywhere but Loughrea. Because I just didn't want to meet people, because you're constantly looking over your shoulder wondering, is it that person? Is it this person? Or, you know, it just, you'd be completely paranoid.
And have they tried to get letters into you? For example, have letters arrived on festive occasions, birthdays or Christmas, that you'd be expecting a birthday card, but it wouldn't be a birthday card?
Yeah, they have. We've gotten Christmas cards, birthday cards were sent when my son turned 21, a birthday card arrived for him. When I turned 50, a birthday card arrived for me. Like, they've stooped so low that after we lost my husband's father very suddenly last year, or 2 years ago it is now,
okay.
They wrote to every member of the family a horrendous letter. They wrote to my boss, we lost my boss the same year in January, and they wrote to his elderly wife, and horrendous letters. You couldn't even... It's toxic poison.
Yeah.
Susan Plower on Wednesday's Liveline. And the following day, her brother-in-law, Kieran, phoned Joe. He too had received some of these letters, but he spoke about the resilience of their family in the face of this unrelenting distress.
It's Dave and Susan are the people that have been impacted. Yeah. Now it's gone out the wider circle of family and friends. God knows how far it's going to go after this, because they have got no, how would you say, they haven't got any momentum trying to break up the family, because that's what their whole intention was at the start, to break up our family. But our family are, there's five lads in the family.
Yeah.
And myself and David are the youngest. And we're very united.
Great.
We're really, really united. Brilliant. And we come together, and it's, well, they're not going to break us up. I can tell you that. So, whatever their angle is, I'm not sure, Joe. But it's not working. So, maybe they've got trying to get to somebody else to get to us. I'm not sure.
From Liveline, back in a bit. Welcome back. Let's just play it, because let's face it, it was always going to make the cut. Baggy trousers, gold chains. We give you Brian Dobson rapping, but of course, he'd done his homework first.
It's much more difficult than it seems. You know, you think, oh, you're just talking to the music, but you're talking to the beat. Now, on the other hand, it's a great way to express yourself, because you don't have to be musical. You don't have to have a singing voice. If talk, and if you can follow a beat, you can rap. And if you've something to say. So what the essence of rap, and it comes out of hip hop, I think, in the Bronx among African Americans.
I'll bow to your greater judgment on this.
So this is all about doing very thorough research on behalf of the Oliver Callan Show. It's about authenticity. So you're expressing. So it's who you are.
Describing this, you're even moving with a certain beat.
Well, actually, it's very important. apparently, it's very important that when you're rapping, you're giving it that sort of physical engagement as well.
Well, without further ado. Big news featuring Snoop Dobb, whatever we'll call him, from the cabin. Here we go. Let's enjoy.
Good evening. The main news tonight. I'm back for one show only, but I'm bringing the cabin crew with me.
I bring the big news. It's Dobbo. You gotta fill these big shoes.
passing on the torch to the young crew. They got a good news story, showing you the power and glory. I got a track to do, I'm gonna rap the news. It's the D-O-double-B-O with the cabin crew in Knocknaheeny, and yes, it's so fun. Let's get the news done. It's not the 6-1 in the cabin tonight. It's a beautiful sight, chilling with the crew, and we're spitting some rhymes. The rappers are composing, their talent is showing. They're the big news today, and their sparks are glowing. They rap it out loud, their pain and joy. No matter where they go, they're always making noise. It's got the cabin correspondents standing by. They're right here in the booth, let me pass the mic.
I got some news to write, but I'ma tell you mine. When I'm writing raps, I start to lose track of time. Writing better than ever, you know I'll do this forever. You think I'm stopping them, never. These bears are golden like treasure.
Today's top story, what's the crack, son? Channel Tiny never got your back turned, only turned up. That's the way you gotta act, son. Better tune in or back up. The best news in Cork, so you better be engaged.
Bring the big news, it's double. You gotta fill these big shoes. Passing on the torch to the young crew, they got a good news story, showing you the power and glory. I bring the big news, it's double, you gotta fill these big shoes. Passing on the torch to the young crew, they got a good news story, showing you the power and glory.
Oh, wow.
That's the news tonight. Thanks for listening.
Big news from Dabo. I think that deserves a bit of clapping and cheering. Party piece, people. That was Brian Thompson as we'd never heard him before. It sounded like you enjoyed that.
I had a great time. I really
Brian Thompson, retired and playing Merry Hell. And we can only follow that with a bit of keening.
Oh, no, guitar, no.
Keening from the Irish Queena for crying. And here is betting that when you think of it, you might think of this.
We all have that image of a group of women, usually in like an old thatch cottage, crying over a dead corpse.
Mm-hmm. But now, as part of the St. Patrick's Day Festival, we have ABBER, Journey of a Lament, at TU Dublin Grange Gorman. And as UCC's Marion Caulfield told Kay on Arena, the oral tradition of keening was really much more than that stereotype.
You know, the keening woman, you know, she was the person who helped everybody to cry, basically, and helped the community in a way to sort of re-establish itself after the deceased had left. And, you know, they talk about the keen as something that maybe resembled in the day something like the five stages of grief, you know, missing him and how awful life was going to be without him, and then talk to the ancestors and then coming around to the fact that he's gone, and there'd be a piece where they'd be calling him back from the dead, or her back from the dead, and then a kind of a general acceptance that he was gone. But often as well, then weaved in amongst that rhetoric would be curses, bitching about the neighbour, or often they can be weaving in things about rebellion. You know, the seat of rebellion is said by some to have started with keening women. The Catholic Church really didn't like the keeners. You know, they were constantly for hundreds of years trying to sort of decry them and you know, banning them and banishing them from from funerals. And then eventually they sort of... funerals kind of were taken over by the Catholic Church, and they left the wake house and went into the respectability of the church. So, you know, it just died out and was stigmatised, and it wasn't a respectable thing to be doing anymore now that we were kind of modern and Catholic and very respectable, you know.
And I guess if they were sowing sedition at some of them, you know,
and
giving
exactly.
out that the, when the British were in charge, yeah. they wouldn't have been too happy about some of these funeral houses.
Well, they wouldn't have liked it. They didn't like it because it was full of secrecy. They didn't understand it. It was in Irish. So, you know, they didn't know what these women were weaving,
yes.
but they knew that they were stirring up something, because, you know, the wakes were fairly drunken, lively places, and get a good woman stirring up the rhetoric around rebellion, and you'd have. But it was they were dangerous voices. You know, they were social influencers of their time, according to some of the experts. You know,
from Arena, and on the lyric feature, Among the Heather Rocks, with poet Anne-Marie Nicquaron, and she spoke to Banfasa Lucy Niehagen about what I think you'll agree is a pretty unusual dress. In fact, it's her wedding dress.
So now I did not make the dress, but I tanned the skins for the dress. So this is 12 wild salmon skins.
So this is a kind of waistcoat.
This is the top. And then this is 11 reindeer skins. So I went up to my friend's tannery up in Norway. They work with local reindeer herders. So then myself and my friend Jessie went up and tanned the skins.
It feels so soft.
So soft. Certainly the top of the gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. I bet the top of the town. I can only imagine that there'd be the odd person who their mind is blown by the fact that there's a bride up there wearing salmon and eels. And
absolutely. In Rooney's nightclub.
And with Brendan at the weekend, Marion Keyes. A wide-ranging interview, but this caught the ear.
You also did an interior design course.
I did. Yeah. I mean, it was something I'd always wanted to do because, like, a long, long time ago, you know, I put two mismatched cushions on a couch and they worked, you know. And like,
you have an eye.
That's what they said, Brendan. That's what they said. And I thought, I have an eye. And I thought, I'm going to do a course. And I thought, I'm going to be brilliant at it. And then somebody will give me a job doing like fabulous bedrooms in a fabulous hotel. And it was always my kind of, I do that now when work calms down and when the time is right. And the time was never right. Yeah. There was always something to do. There was always, like, you know, work to do. And then I turned 60 and I thought, oh my God, you know what? I think I'm going to die one day, because I never believed it till that point. And thought, well, if I want to do this course, am I going to wait till I'm 72, you know, or 81? I thought, no, I'll do it now. So I did a course, and I'm so, like, I didn't learn what I wanted to learn. I thought it would be about the cushions and matching them, yeah, and matching mismatched things and learning about fabrics and colours and beautiful things. And instead I learned how to do floor plans and how to, you know, where to put the light switches on a wall and where to put the electric plugs. That was what...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't sign up for that.
Nevertheless,
it was still good to do it. It was still like this gift to myself. Like, I took nearly a year off work, which felt very scary. But also I thought, look at one day, and this sounds very morbid, I think it's lovely, one day we'll all be dead and none of this will matter. So I might as well do my interiors design course.
And proof positive that it is indeed the little things that make us happy. She talked about these.
I got this fabulous, fabulous measuring tape. One of those yellow ones, you know, those kind of metal ones. And if you flick it, like my one is 8 metres long.
Yeah.
And I was, oh God, I was having such a great time. I was going around the house measuring everything, measuring my husband, you know, just because I could, you know. It was just...
You need to have it hanging on a belt off.
Love it. I really, really would. And then I got a laser one, but the laser one doesn't give you the same kind of... that kind of thrill of the noise of the metal tape flying out across the room. It's
very,
it's beautiful. It really is. Yeah.
The magnificent Marion Keyes. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And for the weekend that's in it, up you get. Push back the table. Be upstanding and dancing for this, our unofficial national anthem.